The opening chapter of the Gospel according to John starts with the words, "In the beginning was the Word." And this term, the Word, has gone around the world in the religions and sacred teachings of nearly all of the great faiths. Every religion has a secret or sacred word, usually a synonym for deity, but also representing the divine process, the outbreathing of existence. In this little planet where we live, probably the only creature that is capable of even attempting to understand the mystery of the Word is man. Humanity has the power not only of speech, but of articulating through speech thoughts, ideas, emotions, and all a wide gamut of intellectualisms, emotionalisms, and physical attitudes. Therefore, we should give some thought to the use of language, use of words. And that is probably especially practical at this time, where we are on the verge of a political campaign in which a great many words are going to be used. They're going to be thrown in all directions. And as we study them, we will realize gradually that words are dedicated to three different levels of usage. The first and most important level is the word as truth. The second is the word as hope. And the third is the word as fear. And even in daily living, many of our word terms and our expressions are used to sustain, support, or protect the individual from some attitude or circumstance which he feels is hazardous or detrimental to himself. So we study the problem carefully. We come to the realization that we are dealing with a very important commodity. Words are not just things. Noah Webster, in the development of his dictionary, made the statement that a dictionary is not a book devoted to the meaning of words. It is devoted to the usages of words. Most of the words that we use, we do not understand. Most of the statements we make are not clear, not positive, and if they are both clear and positive, they may still be untrue. Words are very complicated things, and they should be used with caution. The English language had its rise in the 17th century, in which we have the first great flowering of an intellectual way of life, particularly in poetry, sonnets, in soliloquies, and in various texts of sciences. The Shakespearean plays are a magnificent exhibition of the use of words. Words to convey feelings, ideas, thoughts, and attitudes. Words which can be rhymed, which may remain as prose. Words which sing and words that frighten. All kinds of words are used every day. But the wise person will be thoughtful and try to use words with proper meaning. There is the use, there is the misuse, and there is the abuse. And the use of words should always clarify something. The misuse is apt to complicate something, and the abuse is usually a complete statement of negation or a harmful and destructive application of language. So we start with the beginning, the words as useful, the words as means of communication, the use of words. Now we have to study and realize, to begin with, that there are two levels upon which the human being attempts to function. These are more or less outlined in the concepts of science and the various forms of special research projects. The first problem that we have to face is that words do not actually give you the full meaning of the sounds that you make. They can give meaning, they can give false meaning, they can deny meaning, but very few words can convey the real meaning of themselves. A German college professor a number of years ago kept his students in a sort of lethargy because he would not permit them to question him. He would talk to them about something and said to, "Why is this, professor?" The professor was silent. After a long series of such experiences, the professor finally confessed the facts of life as he understood them. He said, "We can only answer the question why by substituting for it the question how. When we say why, we mean how." Now, this is a simple statement of the fact that we don't know the fact. It is a clear indication that the why is unanswerable, or at least is so dim and obscure that it cannot be applied to any definite situation. We cannot say why with certainty. We do not know why the sun rises, but we know how it rises according to mechanics and astronomical calculations. We do not know why certain things happen, but we know how they happen. We do not know why man was created, but we know how he was created to a degree, so that the use of the word why has been almost abandoned in higher intellectualism because of the simple fact that the individual ultimately has to face his own ignorance and to answer the question that is asked by why would require a knowledge beyond that possessed by the average human being. So we are confronted with the fact that we must deal with secondary facts. Primary fact remains elusive and beyond our comprehension. So we actually are constantly using language with certain defeatism inevitable. In order to speak a language correctly, we have to do what some of our earlier ancestors did, and that is make a life discipline out of language. In other words, if you use words, then you must consider them part of a science that must be conquered by itself. If you wish to be a grammarian correctly, you have to make words a matter of serious consideration. You cannot just open your mouth and let anything come out that it feels like appearing at the moment. It has to be disciplined. To make words consistent or meaningful, they must be disciplined. A superficial statement has very little basic authority and very little probability of complete fulfillment. So we start with the question now as to why we cannot ask the question why. And that is because of the absence of knowledge of first cause. Behind the little world we live in at the moment is a vast purpose. We feel sometimes that we are touching the hem of that purpose. We believe that that purpose can be approached. But in sober substance, all such speculation is lacking in final formality. We cannot answer the question of why the universe was created, or why God in infinite wisdom created the capacity for evil. We don't know, as to one theologian asked, how it happened that when God created paradise, he also made the snake. Now, did he or didn't he? And then we come to the why again, and we don't know the answer. We do not know most of the answers that are in depth. And this in itself is important. It tells us something that we all should understand. We should realize that the use of knowledge is largely to discover the cause and source of things. But in our daily lives, we do not pay much attention to this. We are content to drift along on the surface, allowing the moods of the moment to control the use of words. this is not the way it should be. At school, for instance, we learn to liken words to objects. But even when we apply the word to the object, we have lost something. We have lost inner meaning. We call things by the name. We say, this is a carrot. And we therefore get a good mark on our examination paper. But what is a carrot? Neither the student nor the teacher knows, actually. It becomes merely a term to define the fact that we have accepted the language which we are studying, and that in that language, this particular vegetable is a carrot. But this does not tell us a thing about the carrot. It only divides it from some other vegetable. Why it is divided, how it is divided, what the life means, we do not know. But from the very earliest times, human beings attempted to find ways of learning the true meaning of the things which they classified. And in the old hieroglyphic languages, they aided themselves by making pictures of the object. Pictures be carved in stone, or pressed into clay, or written on paper or parchment. They made likenesses of the thing they were trying to discover or decide. And in this way, they had a little more dimension than we get from words, because we add picture or likeness, and this becomes a very valuable factor. But all the way along, particularly in the modern world, words have to be carefully considered and weighed. They can be the cause of war. They can result in riots. They can bring down the stock exchange in a bad catastrophe. They can do all kinds of things to us that we do not appreciate or understand. And just as we are not permitted by law to injure other persons physically, we must sometimes realize that we can more profoundly influence and injure them verbally. Words are powerful things. The ancients had the magic of words. They used mantras, spells, incantations, by means of which they could produce various magical effects. Words in prayer are used by most religions as a means of invoking the presence of deity or placing the mind in a mood of receptivity to truth. Words have always been very powerful things. They were powerful before they could be written. And in the writing down of words, we again produced certain misstatements which we have had very great difficulty in trying to correct. But for all intents and purposes, at the moment at least, we are working with a verbalization that can change the course of history. Every single word that we use can be of profound influence upon our future, or bring back material from the past which were best forgotten. To use words, then, we must use them correctly. Up to about 100 years ago, in the public school system of most civilized countries, language was a very basic subject. We did not simply grow up and become able to speak languages because of environment and circumstance. The English language is a very important language, but it is one that is seldom studied scientifically and philosophically for the purpose of knowing the true strength, meaning, and power of word sound. The Oriental people have realized that every letter of the alphabet and all combinations of letters are magical patterns, magical forms. They even go further than this. In Indian philosophy, each letter of the alphabet is a living deity. And out of the combinations of these deities, sounds are produced. The vocal cords are a kind of vena, by means of which the individual can make a melody of his thoughts, emotions, attitudes, and beliefs. But words are alive. They are powerful. The esotericists of Europe, such as the Rosicrucians and those schools, held that words were so powerful that once spoken, they never die. That a word goes on as a rate of vibration forever. and that from the lyrics must ultimately be born a new form of generation by which propagation will be by the spoken word. This is found in the writings of the old alchemists and others who realized that the vocal cords were the positive pole of the generative system, and that the vocal cords would actually come in due time to be the source of all eternal life. That all lives that have a continuance, either in time or space, are produced by vibration, and vibration is man's instrument of creation. We don't realize this now, and probably won't for a long time, but the fact remains that if we say a word, that this is a sound that is a part of life. It becomes an eternal part, just as much as a germ or a cell or any other minute unit of life goes on, even though its echo dies out. So we know that if we say a word that is destructive, that it adds to the burden of the world's misery. All these different things, like different types of a human error, accumulate. We find that temper builds up. We find that all kinds of moods and attitudes become deeper and more powerful until finally, who knows, the answer is a whirlwind or a tornado. But all destructive vibrations do continue long after we do not hear them or see the consequences anymore. Everything that is negative destroys part of the harmony of life. And as long as the human being is devoted to anger, hate, fear, jealousy, he will also have to pay for these moods in sickness and misery. Therefore, in using words, we should be very careful to use only the ones, and you use them properly, that will most likely produce concord, harmony, amity, and relationship. In this particular case, I think in the words we can say that use of a word is to convey meaning as far as is possible. The word is used to say something that is, to us at least, true. It might not be true to another person, but if it comes from the true course of our own integrity, then the word is properly used. In conversation, there is no need to constantly consider these techniques, but there is an over problem which is usually solved by outside circumstances. By religion, for example, the individual is induced not to use destructive words. He is not permitted in his religion to nurse hatreds, nurse jealousies, or think or speak ill of other people. This being true, the words themselves are tempered and become less powerful for a destructive end. Also, the use of good words accumulates. The kind word never dies. The gentle word never dies. The creative, the helpful, the hopeful words, these live on. They go not only to the person to whom they address them, but they are rates of vibration. A word is something that man can create, but which does not die after it is once created. Therefore, words like thoughts and emotions are immortal. They go on long after what we have suspected they stood for. And the word in itself, passing into another life, another person's life, and influences the life of that person, changes a habit, corrects a mistake, strengthens a hope, and therefore continues to be an immortal factor, not only to the person, but to the generations which follow after. Also, therefore, the misuse of words is a very serious mistake. Now, a misuse can come from ignorance, which the individual cannot help because he is not well enough informed. But on the other hand, if he is ignorant and he uses the wrong words and gets himself into difficulties, this should be an inducement to overcome or change the basic nature of the individual himself. Usually, negatively used words in good-natured people represents a type of ignorance. It represents the fact that the individual does not think carefully or does not actually know the correct approach to a verbalization of something that they hold as important. But it is definitely part of life that any individual who can speak, anyone who can use words, must be able to understand words and must recognize basic meanings and use these basic meanings whenever possible. Not long ago, a couple of professors got together to have a very hot and contested argument between two schools of philosophy. And instead of starting out browbeating each other, each one said to the other, "Before we start this discussion, what is going to be the keynote? What is going to be the basis of our discussion? Are we going to follow Immanuel Kant primarily, or are we going to follow Leibniz? What type of philosophy is to provide us with the terms we are both going to use? If one speaks as Kant and the other speaks as Leibniz, the argument is inevitable and the consequences are uncertain. Someone will not understand and the other one will probably misunderstand. So first decide the words you're going to use before you start using them. Do not speak in a way that the person you address cannot hope to understand your meaning or has a meaning so different from yours that the facts cannot be disseminated. Try to find a common ground of language. The common ground of language, as the Pythagoreans noted, is the simplest possible approach. All affectation in words leads to obscuration. The more difficult the words, the more learned they sound, the less they impart in terms of value. Pythagoras suggested definitely that the best way to correct the difficulties of language was to keep quiet. And he advised this so firmly that he practiced 5 years of silence himself and required the same action on the part of his disciples. If an individual doesn't speak at all for 5 years, he's going to make a series of discoveries. And much later, several hundred years later, Apollonius of Tyana became a Pythagorean long after Pythagoras had departed. But he decided also to take the 5 year silence in order to test his own inner resources. He also found out, as they do in India, that silence is an answer in many ways. First of all, the individual does not make a very serious mistake by not passing judgment. He also does not get himself into too involved a situation in conflicts of ideas, and he is inclined also to allow the person to solve his own problems, which most of us are slow to allow. We like to, when the person brings a problem to us, our first thought is to solve it for him. We will solve it the way we would want it to be solved. It might have nothing to do with what he needs, but it would be satisfying to ourselves to know that we have dominated him, over-influenced him, and made him agree with us. As a consequence of being silent for 5 years, we escape all such responsibility. On several occasions, Pythagoras used silence as a means of sound. He used it as a kind of music, as mysterious silence, here and there in conversation, words left out but implied only, so that the listener was able to decide for himself what the real meaning was, rather than allow the master to force a meaning upon him. Following this same habit, Apollonius, on several occasions, made tremendous contributions to the improvement of society without speaking. On two occasions, he stopped a riot without opening his mouth. His mere presence and the dignity of his silence stopped the riot. Whereas had he taken sides, it might have continued for hours and days and had many terrible consequences. Silence is often the best answer to questions that are highly controversial. If they are highly controversial, it is obvious that there will not be a common agreement. It is also possible and obvious that if the individual is forced to agree against his will by the weight of argument alone, which does not, however, actually convince him or convert him, then he will continue the same mind and will fight out the situation at a later period. There is no need for this type of thing. Now, in our daily life, we also should censor our words. Today, we are confronted with a tremendous array of bad taste in connection with words. Entertainment is loaded with words, thoughts, and attitudes now made vocal, which are against the better taste and judgment of mankind. We also know that the various plays have moral and psychological influence, which is unworthy and unreasonable. Therefore, the answer is, one way is to keep your mouth shut, and the other way to close your eyes. With those two objectives attained, the individual is then able to think for himself. The problem of rescuing the mind from exposure to ulterior motives and propaganda is a very real and serious problem today. Most of the difficulties that are confronting two-thirds of the world are due to words, badly chosen, backed by force, motivated by jealousies and greed, and with no values in the basic purposes of life. The Neoplatonists of Alexandria used the concept of words to be a sacred procedure, that any word that is spoken must come from the soul. If it does not arise in the soul and bring the mind into order, then it cannot be safely communicated to the outside world. All of the way along, the individual must put a bridle on his own tongue and must use words to be of value to society and to himself. Nearly everyone gets into trouble with words. Homes are broken by them. Arguments split families wide apart. They also divide nations, continents. Everything you can think of will come into verbal conflict over words. These words are used often to support physical force or to cause it. Actually, most of the troubles of mankind are due to too much talk and too many arguments, which are totally unnecessary. Many creatures do not speak. They do not need to, because habit and instinct and a kind of psychic overtone gives them the communication they need. With man, however, the problem of speech remains to the bitter end a matter of great concern to all human beings. Historians, of course, use words to influence the reader, and it is generally admitted today that 90% of history is written by victors at the expense of the vanquished. We always make a villain out of the loser, regardless of the circumstances. So we have all kinds of problems in history. We take the words, we believe them, but we don't know whether they are true or not. We make truth choice on the basis of what we want or what we expect or what is in common to our present consideration. We decide that the historian is correct if we agree with him. He is incorrect if we disagree with him, when in reality the facts of the matter are seldom actually considered. There's the use and misuse, and there's an abuse of words. Now, the most basic abuse of words, of course, was in the medieval and ancient times in magic, black magic. All kinds of spells and invocations came into existence for the purpose of injuring people, destroying enemies by psychic means, the invoking of spirits, the invoking of demoniacal monsters. The whole science of necromancy was based upon spells, conjurations of words. Also, we might know that opposed to these are prayers, which are probably the highest usage that we make of words. is to pray if our prayer is simple and honest. If our prayer is greedy, or if we are very highly selfish in our thinking religiously, then we fall back into trouble. But we may say that prayer is the white magic of words, and that necromancy, spells, and conjurations are the black magic. So that every word that we do say, regardless of what it is, has some kind of a consequence. It may be spoken to the winds, but it still has a consequence. It may be spoken in haste or at leisure, but it is still an important thing, and it is something that should not be allowed to escape the control of the will or the integrity. We find people who would never really hurt anyone who will lie about them. We know we people who will gossip and who love to carry stories and things of that nature. We find others who have a tendency to downgrade anyone who is in their environment because of jealousies. We find all kinds of misuse of words to the satisfaction of negative attitudes or purposes. This is something that, from the standpoint of our daily life, we should give a lot of thought to. Because over the telephone in the course of the day, enough gossip goes back and forth to break 1,000 homes. It's not intended to do it. It's not done from complete viciousness. But it comes from the idea of communicating something not generally known and enjoying the sense of being party to a secret. In all substance, these things are wrong, and let's see, the vibratory consequences are worth considering. Suppose for a moment you have a little bit of gossip that sounds rather good to you, and you want to tell your friends about it. There are things happening inside of yourself. The first thing that might happen to you would be to question the integrity of the information. This, however, is usually passed over lightly. We assume that our friend knew. The second problem is, who is it going to help? Is the sharing of this information going to improve something, or is it going to make something worse, discredit or disparage? Usually, gossip and slander hurt. But that's not where it ends. That little phrase that hurts, or the thought behind it, keeps right on living. It gradually mingles with others, and gradually we build a political situation, or build a domestic situation, or a community situation, in which values are destroyed by loose talking, or by uninformed communication. All these things add up. They don't fade away. They do not disappear into oblivion. These things keep on living, and the ancient people believed that all these little thoughts became imps. All negative things were little demons, all beautiful things were little angels. And that the individual guards himself by surrounding his life only with good things. And the good things in this case being a consciousness within himself of fairness and integrity and of forgiveness. There are many cases in which forgiveness is an important problem in vocalization. People want to be forgiven, or they may want to forgive. The effort, however, may or may not be successful. In either case, we have the person vocalizing an attitude. And this vocalization, as my old phrenologist friend, Dr. Bronson, used to say, this is an attitude that comes out of your mouth and goes into your own ear. In other words, it goes around the side of your face and goes back to you. Whatever comes out of the mouth goes back into the mind. If there is inharmony, there is cruelty, there is thoughtlessness coming out of the mouth, that will return into the brain itself or into the mind. And the problem of the mind as a factor in communication must always be remembered. Each person, before he settles down to becoming a philosopher or going into the higher mysticism, should make a fair estimation of his own character and temperament. He should look for the problems that are difficult for him, and if he is uncertain, he may be brave enough to ask a friend or two what they think about him. This takes a great deal of courage and has broken a great many friendships. But it is still a very useful thing to do. We should be grateful for it, but we seldom are. But in any event, these things, everything in life is a motion. It is a vibration. It is a living thing that affects other living things. And therefore, thoughts are things. Words are things. The mere fact that there was no witness to what we said doesn't mean that it is not there and will remain. The witness may show up years from now. But within the individual himself, everything that he says and everything that is said to him has a life, has a vitality, has a continuance. The nagger sets up a pattern which turns against himself. Now, nature has many ways of punishing mistakes. In the most common way, in words and things of that nature, is to punish them by getting someone else to say something unpleasant or unkind as a retort. It ends in an argument. The two individuals get locked in a debate which makes both of them ill, leaves them tired and distracted and unfit for the common responsibilities of living. We can't afford it, especially now. At this particular stage of our international relationships, words can be very dangerous. They can cause the individual to lose track of his own growth because he becomes immersed in something which he can do nothing about. It is much better to be calm, mild, thoughtful, and retain judgment and refrain from all personal animosities. We cannot afford to hate people even if they're wrong. We cannot afford to spread false rumors simply to become part of an electional procedure. These things endanger the future of nations, and they do the same thing in the private life of individuals. A little gossip and a little slander can break a home and destroy the lives of the children trying to grow up in that home. Everything that is possible in words and in thought and in action should be constructive. It must have a meaning that helps and not by meaning that hurts. It must add to something and not detract from anything. It should add to a better way of living. Therefore, we have another interesting division. The Greeks said that man speaks in prose, but the gods speak in verse. Most of the scriptural bookings of the world were originally in the form of poetry. The sagas and Eddas, the Upanishads, all the different sacred books were done originally in verse. Most of the Old Testament was at one time in verse. Verse was the language of the gods because it was rhythmic, harmonic, and beautiful. And it went along with a certain cadence within itself. It continued to appeal, and good poetry still is a marvelous civilizing force. So the gods spoke only in hexameter verse. Prose was the language of mortals. And as the immortality in us comes out, our prose becomes poetic. And therefore we have all kinds of minor poets who have never ascended to the great epic level, but who still have begun to find the charm and joy of saying things beautifully, and saying them in a nice and gentle manner. Then we have some modern poetry like modern art, which is very poor, very fretful, very brittle. This does not help. The whole problem of life, whether it's in speech or action or thought, is that which is beautiful in principle is good. This means that it's beauty in the substance of itself, not in its appearance. But that which is beautiful means that which is ideal, idealistic, that which is harmonic, that which is reconciling of differences. All of these things become the burden and opportunity of the peacemaker, who is entirely and certainly rewarded for it. Blessed is the peacemaker. So we have in language all these things to think about. Our children today are not taught basic language. They are taught the names of things and believe if they have the name that they know the thing. So if someone asks them, what is a carrot? they are apt to say a vegetable and get the correct marking. But they don't know what a character is or a carrot or anything else. They do not understand, but they consider the subject closed by the name. And the same is true in many different developments of life. We give names to things, answer them according to their names, and consider that enough. This is one of the points that was made by Comenius and Holbeck in connection with education. The problem of finding out the name of things in terms of meaning. And the way to gain meaning is to recognize the basic vitality of the subject under discussion. Hartlib made the point of this, and so did Comenius. In other words, you have to be able to feel the facts of a thing, not merely listen to it by dictionary. You have to participate in the experience of something in order to know it. And that was why such an emphasis was placed upon preschool education. The problem is very certain that the faculties of true understanding have to be developed before schooling comes, or the schooling will be very largely rejected. We will finally end up with the individual memorizing the words and knowing nothing about the substance. So the person has to learn to recognize substance first. And the first substances of life are not learned in school, but in the preschool period of childhood, in which association with other adults or with others of its own age group results, these result in certain basic experiences of like and dislike, of exception and acceptance and rejection. These things we gradually learn intuitively. Then when education comes, we give meaning to words. Otherwise, we give no meaning. And we just keep on using words without giving them any substance, essence, or vitality. Students working with the various systems of thought today also will find a study of words very rewarding in connection with beliefs. We have probably 30 or 40 systems of religious philosophy in the world that are of some interest and importance. In almost all of these systems, there is a vocabulary. They have names for things. They have names for deity. They talk about the 72 names of God. All these things. But the real study of language and words gives us the full sense of this. In other words, these are not separate beings. These are separate language names for the same being. Instead, therefore, of having a group of pagans and heathens, we have divided from each other only by word for name. That the person who worships Brahma is the same person who worships some other deity under another name. But it is actually the same God. And the realization that this could in itself alone, through a study of language, practically end all sectarian differences of belief. Because if the quality of the beliefs are the same, but the names are different. And as long as we know them by their names only, and do not know their qualities, we are unable to cope with the situation. So everywhere meaning reconciles words. Whereas ignorance keeps these words separated, creates civil wars over words, where there is no need for it at all. Now, in our modern life, we have another kind of problem that seems to be coming up, and that is the basing of language. They are becoming more basal in its tonality. We have gone downward into what we might term basic English, but which is really, very largely, the lowest possible use of words. We use, therefore, profanity and many things of this nature, which become common usage, without realizing that all of these things are just as dangerous to our system as marijuana and cocaine. The destruction of the overtones of a language can be a great disaster to the human being. It can subjugate that human being to a level of life very much below that for which it was originally intended. It is necessary, therefore, to correct much of the problem of life through a better understanding of language. We have it here now more than we did have, because in this country, for instance, we are bringing in peoples of many different nations and races. We are creating a highly polyglot civilization. And these civilizations will remain more or less separated for several generations because of their ancestral backgrounds and because of their particular religious emphasis.